From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a look at how road diets can help curb reckless driving in Wisconsin. Then there are many factors to consider when choosing an electric vehicle over a gasoline one, including how clean the electric vehicle actually is.
In reality, you're using your electricity to charge the car up. Well, the power plant down the road is what's providing that, and in many places, especially in the Midwest, that's a coal-fired plant.
And writer David Sedaris talks about the pros and cons of having candid conversations with people at his readings.
And there's a lot to be said for not getting it out there, you know. So I started writing when I was 20, and I don't think anyone saw, outside of letters, a word that I had written until I was 28. And I'm glad of that, because I think people would have looked at what I'd written and said, okay, well, he's no good.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. There's an epidemic of reckless driving in Milwaukee. Drivers have been blowing through stop signs, weaving through traffic, and passing in bike lanes. And law enforcement has been cracking down on this behavior. But there are many solutions to reckless driving, which can include redesigning streets to encourage better driving behavior. These redesigns are frequently referred to as road diets, and they're shown to decrease accidents and reduce the fatalities in crashes. Kevin Muse is the executive director of the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, an organization working to solve transit issues in the region. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, glad to join you.
So, you know, we're talking about road diets, but part of the conversation, I think, has to be about four-lane roads in general. So, you know, these are very common in metropolitan areas especially. What makes these roads dangerous?
Sure. So there's nothing that universally makes a four-lane road dangerous. It really depends on a lot of design attributes to it. One of the most challenging four-lane roads, though, especially if you're walking or even navigating an area that you're unfamiliar with, is a four-lane undivided. A good example in the Milwaukee area would be like King Drive, just north of downtown. MLK there is two driving lanes and then a parking lane in each direction, so a four-lane road. And frankly, it's just really wide to get across from someone who's walking's perspective, from a pedestrian's perspective. So that is one element of the danger. The other thing that's going on with a four-lane undivided road is there typically aren't a lot of turn lanes. And so people, when they're trying to turn left or right, are essentially making an unexpected maneuver to the people behind them, which causes a lot of weaving and changing of lanes, and people try to do it at high speeds. And so that can be really dangerous as well when you don't give people a specific lane for turns at a fast-moving road like that. It can really increase the danger for everybody involved. So it's not really inherently four-lane roads. It has to do with design. It has to do with how wide the road is. And then it really has to do with speed as well.
Yeah. So, of course, we're talking about road diets. What is a road diet?
Sure. So typically a road diet, in a slightly more narrower definition, is when you take a road that might have too many driving lanes, travel lanes in it, and you reprioritize that space. And so, say, again, using an example of like King Drive, or another example that's actually been done in Milwaukee would be South 2nd Street, where two lanes in each direction. And if you wanted to, like they did with South 2nd Street, they put some of that space onto wider sidewalks and a little bit of green space for trees and things like that. They put in bike lanes and those sorts of things. And now 2nd Street is one lane in each direction. And so that's what's typically considered a road diet. Something that kind of gets included in road diets, but within the transportation world isn't necessarily the same thing, is more a broader group of just traffic calming measures. So these are things that you don't necessarily have to change how many driving lanes there are on a street, but you could do what are called curb bump outs or bulb outs, so that at the intersection, you move the curb rather from being at the edge of the parking lane, you move it out to the edge of the bike lane or the driving lane, so that the distance people have to cross across the intersection when they're on foot or on wheels is shorter. So people who are walking or using a mobility device don't have to travel as far. And those are sometimes included in a road diet, sometimes not. But other traffic calming measures can also improve the environment and increase safety too, similar to the way a road diet does.
What are some examples of traffic calming measures and different ways that a road might be dieted? Of course, you mentioned bike lanes as being one element.
Mm-hmm. So it's very specific to what the current environment is on that road, how it's being used right now. Is there more lanes, more driving lanes than you need? Do you have excess capacity? And then also just the width of street you have to deal with. And many parts of Milwaukee and other even inner suburban areas of the metro area, there are buildings in the way, so you only have so much width. But based on the situation you have, you might be adding either painted bike lanes, or the city's experimenting right now with even some protected bike lanes, which have a bit of physical separation from moving vehicles. I mentioned curb bump outs and bulb outs for pedestrians. And those are probably the main things that are considered on more on larger streets. On some smaller streets, sometimes things like traffic circles or speed humps also help slow traffic down and make it a more welcoming environment for all users.
In a lot of these cases, it sounds like part of the solution is getting rid of lanes and also making some spaces more narrow. And just intuitively, that sounds less safe. Why is it safer?
Sure. So it really depends on, again, the existing circumstances on the street. But when you give automobiles more space than they need, people tend to just drive faster. It feels safer to be moving more quickly. And if people in automobiles are moving more quickly, that means that everybody else who isn't in an automobile is more likely to die or be seriously injured if they have any interaction with that car, if they're hit or anything like that. So it can cause, depending on how you rearrange it, it might cause more fender benders or something like that. But everything will be happening at a lower speed, so it's going to decrease your serious injuries and your fatalities related to that street.
How much does, decreasing speed by, let's say, just 5-10 miles per hour, how much does that actually decrease the risk of an accident?
Even the difference between an automobile traveling at 40 miles an hour hitting a pedestrian or versus an automobile traveling at 25 miles an hour, there's a huge difference in survivability for the pedestrian. Once you get down to 25 miles an hour or so, it's something like 90% of people survive. And when you go up towards 35, 40 miles an hour, it drops to less than half of people survive when they're hit by an automobile, when they're a pedestrian. So it causes a pretty dramatic shift in survivability.
Yeah. I should not laugh. That it's just a little shocking.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, geez.
Makes a big difference.
So one of the things when I was looking up road diets and kind of their efficacy, one of the things that was mentioned, the traffic points at which people tend to get in accidents, specifically what they were talking about was turning lanes. So when you kind of transform one of the existing lanes of traffic into a turning lane, how does that decrease the points of accidents?
Sure. So, and this gets back to your question around four-lane roads. If you were to take a four-lane road and turn it into one driving lane in each direction and then what's called a twiddle, which is those left turn lanes that are continuous, double-striped down the middle of a road so people can turn left wherever they need to into driveways or businesses or things like that. Really what that does is it allows people to get out of traffic, moving traffic, to make that left turn. So they can make it an essentially two stages rather than thinking, okay, I'm going to brake, stop everybody behind me who may or may not be expecting me to brake and make a quick left turn. You can get out of the lane, brake, and then think about your left turn. And so it improves decision-making by the driver, but it also removes that vehicle from the moving traffic lane, the through lane, which allows, decreases the chances of somebody behind them rear-ending them or causing some sort of back-to-back collision between vehicles.
So when we're talking about road diets and the Milwaukee area, you mentioned South 2nd Street was an example of a street that went through its own road diet. Are there any other prominent examples, both in Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area, that have undergone this kind of process?
Sure. There are likely numerous examples. Ones that I've thought of most recently, South Second Street was a big initiative. And frankly, that was really led by the businesses in the neighborhood around it, interacting with the Department of Public Works and how they designed that street to a pretty good result, I think most would argue. Another one that the city relatively recently completed was South Fifth Street, roughly in the same area. I mean, it's almost the entire extent of South Fifth Street between essentially the interstate and the Menominee Valley. So that's another one that was narrowed recently. And a lot of the space on there, not only making it a better pedestrian environment, but redoing South Fifth Street also allowed the city to install a lot of green infrastructure. And that improves, of course, stormwater drainage and things like that and the environmental qualities of that area. Another prominent example in the region recently would be the Village area along State Street in Wauwatosa. They're actually still working, I believe, on the last phase of that right now. It's been a multi-year process because of how the street network works there. Lots of pieces that needed to be moved, but they really increased the pedestrian environment, really slowed down traffic with some creative, what's called a speed table, or essentially raising the street so that the pedestrians and the cars are at the same level, which encourages the cars to slow down and take the area more cautiously. And other narrowings and rearrangements they did in that area have been pretty impressive, too.
You know, I think some people might hear this conversation and go, all of this seems to lead to slower cars and, you know, perhaps more traffic. Do roads that have gone through, you know, the dieting process, do they have worse traffic?
I think that really gets to picking the correct roads to do this on. So different roads have different purposes as far as, are they predominantly a road for through traffic, or are they predominantly a road serving residents or businesses directly on the street? So are people using that road mostly to get to the destinations right in that area, or are they using it to get through an area? And if they're using that road mostly to get to the destinations in that area, it's not going to have a significant impact on their travel time, and really it's going to improve everything that happens after they park their car. So it's going to improve getting to those businesses. It's going to give those businesses more sidewalk space so they can have cafe tables and things like that. So it really adds more vibrancy to a neighborhood. There's this kind of interesting conversation in the urban planning world about basically good congestion versus bad congestion. And in neighborhoods and things like that, you really want some congestion because it shows that the neighborhood's vibrant and economically successful. If someone can fly through a residential neighborhood, that's probably a neighborhood that's not really in great economic shape. Whereas, you know, we don't put bicyclists on the interstate, or, you know, pedestrian crossings on the interstate, because that the primary purpose of the interstate is to move traffic. It's not necessarily about the neighborhoods that are directly adjacent to it.
Yeah. Well, Kevin Muse, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
All right. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Kevin Muse is the executive director of the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission. Coming up, a look at electric vehicles. Will they always serve a niche market, or are they the wave of the future? Our automotive contributors weigh in when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Electric cars have come a long way over the past few decades, but they still only run a short distance. Once limited to traveling less than 100 miles before needing a recharge, some modern electric vehicles have doubled that mileage. But that still pales in comparison to most gas-powered cars, which can travel around 300 to 400 miles on a full tank. So how are these fully electric vehicles doing in the marketplace? And how quickly will their technology catch up to consumers' needs and desires? Lake Effect's automotive contributors Dan Harmon and Mark Savage weigh in.
I guess what's impressive to me is that the electric cars are coming on stronger and stronger, and they have more distance, more range than they used to have, and there's more of them out there. Now, granted, it's a lot more on the expensive end of the market, but there are a few inexpensive ones or semi-inexpensive ones that most of the rest of us could afford.
And what classifies an electric car, anyway, as inexpensive or less expensive these days?
Less expensive these days, I'm test driving a Nissan Leaf right now, and the Leaf starts around $30,000. The Chevy Bolt is about $37,000, Bolt with a B, and the Volkswagen Golf E also is about $30,000-$31,000, I think.
There are other cars that are not available in a lot of the country. Like on the West Coast, I know the Fiat 500e is available, but I think only in California and Oregon, not Washington, which is electric car friendly, oddly enough.
Right. There are a couple others that are out there that like I say, don't have the widespread distribution just yet. But I suppose in the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, you'll be seeing those almost everywhere, too.
And then what about Tesla's quote-unquote less expensive entry?
That is less expensive, but I think it's also $37,000 to $39,000, something like that for starters. And I got to say, the Leaf that I'm driving right now is $44,000. So when I learned that, I was a little bit shocked. And there is still the $7,500 rebate from the government on it. But those phase out after a while, and Nissan is getting close to that where it starts to phase out on them, I think, at the 200,000 vehicle level. So that's great if you can get in on it and get in on it now. That lowers the price of your car. And this one's loaded, and it's also the Plus version, and the Plus version has a lot more mileage. The standard Leaf goes 130 to 150 miles on a charge, and this one goes up to 220 to 250 on a charge. I just charged mine over the last couple of days because it takes about 35 hours to totally recharge this thing on a 110 line, and it's at 100%. I used about 5% to drive, you know, 18 miles to downtown. It's easy, and I got to say this. My wife never comments on the cars I drive other than if they were particularly nice. When we drove around in this, she said, I would love this car. This car drives nice. It's easy to ride in. It's got a real decent ride to it. And it's, of course, quiet because it's electric. And with 220-mile range, I mean, you can drive back and forth from here to Madison, and not all the cars used to be able to do that. But, you know, I think that the cars that are the all-electrics are really making great strides over the last couple of years with the better batteries and better range.
And when you say it took 36 hours to charge that Leaf, is that from almost no charge at all, or is that at least halfway to full?
I believe I had 33% battery life left, and then it was plugged in for really the last 2 days because we were using our other car because we were carrying mulch. So it probably was done charging sometime yesterday. But, you know, most of us, if we had a car that maybe did 220 miles of range, we can drive to and from work for probably the entire week and then plug it in over the weekend and be charged up and ready to go for the next week. And that's one of the advantages of this is not only do you have zero emissions for that time period, but you're not buying gas to put into it. And at least from what I understand, and I haven't really seen any good numbers on this, but to plug your car in and charge it for the next day or two is a lot cheaper than putting in $20, $30, $40 worth of gas every week.
That's what I was getting at with it is that if you only use 40 miles a day, you probably can charge that overnight and use the nighttime electricity rates rather than doing it for 36 hours straight.
Right, correct. You could just pull it into the garage. And, you know, we've talked about advantages and disadvantages of electric cars in the past. But to me, one of the big disadvantages, if you're an apartment dweller and you don't have a garage or an easy place to plug things in, I mean, that's a disadvantage. These still are best for people who, you know, have a garage and they can quickly plug it in. And as I said before we got on the air, I would probably want to put a 220 line into my garage so that I can quick and easy charge the whole thing up for 6 hours or so and be done with it and not have to worry about, you know, am I going to leave it overnight for 2 or 3 days if I'm not ready to go immediately. That's kind of a tough thing.
And as electric car friendly as the West Coast is, where I live now, even if you don't live in a house, most garages have a car charging station, but you can't park it overnight just because there are other people who will want to use that charging station. So you can only use it until your car is charged, and then you have to move it to another spot.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the big disadvantages is beyond the mileage, if you're good with the 200 and some miles, if you're going somewhere longer, it's hard to find a charging station and how long do you have to sit there to recharge if you're going on a trip? And I guess, you know, as time goes on, there'll be more and more of those charging stations. I know Kohl's and a few other places are starting to add some in various spots. But again, my thought is what I pull up there and I, you know, want to plug mine in and there's only two and they're already used, then what do I do? So, but that's one of the disadvantages. And if we can for a second, just talk on the various advantages and disadvantages of the electrics again. And that is, you know, yes, there's no emissions. They're quieter. You know, they have great torque. You know, the acceleration of these is like a little sports car. So that's always fun. But in reality, you're using your electricity to charge the car up. Well, the power plant down the road is what's providing that. And in many places, especially in the Midwest, that's a coal-fired plant. And according to some studies that I've looked at, if you have a coal-fired plant that's providing your electricity, you're about equal with having a good hybrid electric car that gets 40 to 50 miles per gallon. You're going to have the same emissions. You don't have any emissions while you're driving it, but the coal power plant to create it is you know, churning out some emissions there.
Okay. I have no follow-up to that. Just because I've heard the opposite of that, and it does depend on the source of your power. The emissions from a power plant can still be cleaner than those of lots of cars.
That is true, and I should say that the study that I looked at said that over the lifetime of the car, you probably still are about 50% of the overall emissions of a normal gasoline-powered car, even being powered by the coal-fired electric plant. If you got a nuclear plant nearby or a one that's natural gas, then you're really way up there. Then it's more like 10 or 15% of the emissions that the others would have had. So that's good. But I just think it needs to be noted that it's not a completely clean thing. Plus, of course, you got to make the batteries. There's rare minerals that go into these things. So there are some, you know, mining processes probably in places that we don't even think about. They're maybe doing some strip mining and so forth to create the batteries.
And I'm always amused at that discussion as well, that as far as emissions, but the long-term discussion is more of we're not going to have a choice. How long will it be before we don't have fossil fuels, in which case that argument becomes irrelevant? The bigger question being more about conservation and the next step as far as what actually drives the car or powers it or fuels it.
Well, right. I guess my thought is for anyone who's buying an all-electric vehicle, you know, they're looking to have less emissions on a daily basis and overall, you know, but they're also trying to help conserve the petroleum products that we have out there that we know are used in so many of different things, not just in the cars. And, you know, in the long term, I think we will see more electrics. But for the in-between times, which I feel we're in right now, the hybrids still are a great choice because, you know, you get a little of the best of both worlds and just extend your car's easy driving ability. And, you know, that's a big plus for most of us. If you're lucky enough to be able to own two cars, this is a great city car, a great thing to have, you know, for a run to Madison for the weekend or to Green Bay for the weekend or whatever. So, and they drive great. I am very impressed with the Leaf that I'm driving right now.
And I love your phrase, the in-between times. It does sound a little more ominous.
Well, I think we all know, you know, that there's a rational side to most of us that knows that, you know, the oil will not last forever. No one's saying it's going to run out in the next 5 or 10 years, but the longer we can put off its running out, then the more we can use it in other ways to either make other products that we want or need or feel we need. And obviously, there's more and more talk about the global climate change. And if we can start cutting our emissions, the carbon emissions in particular, then all the better. And I think certainly for large cities and areas that are highly polluted, then we need to consider, more people need to consider doing an all-electric. And because of the changes that have been happening over the last 2 or 3 years, that becomes much more tolerable, I think, and more acceptable to the consumer.
And the Leaf was the trendsetter, kind of the one that got it all started. So I'm wondering, A, I'd like to hear your impressions of the changes with the Leaf, and B, what's happened with electric cars in general? Since the last time we talked about electric cars, there are many new entries in the market and other changes. So do the changes in the Leaf echo the rest of the pack? In other words, is it still a trendsetter, or is it just kind of one of the others?
Well, I haven't driven all of the others out there. I'm hoping I get the Jag that we talked about earlier. That'd be a fun drive, and just to see how different, you know, that extreme version of an electric is. And Tesla doesn't loan anything out because they don't need us, because they're so busy getting good publicity most of the time on their own. But the Leaf and the Bolt, which is the Chevy vehicle, those are both of similar ilk in my mind, in that they have long ranges, you know, over 200 miles of range at a fairly reasonable price, depending on whether you can get the government rebate at this point or the tax break. So that's all good. These are both comfortable cars, the Bolt and the Leaf. They drive nicely. They steer pretty much like a little sports car. They have the acceleration of a sports car. Yet the one that I'm driving right now is a hatchback. If it didn't say zero emissions on it a couple places, you would think it's another Nissan Versa or Sentra hatchback, and it drives nice. I mean, you would not notice any drastic difference between this and some other gasoline-powered hatchback, except it's quieter. It's kind of funny because you get in and you press the start button, and other than the dash coming on, nothing really happens. And then you slide it into gear and you know, go backwards or forwards, and it's, you know, a lot like driving a golf cart, only with a little more pep and obviously a lot more vehicles surrounding you. There's good storage in the back. The batteries give it a low center of gravity, so it handles well on the highway, and it handles well, you know, in kind of the fast curves that you might want to take if you go out on the country roads. And it's just a nice vehicle that if you were paying $25,000 to $30,000 for it, you would think you got a heck of a bargain. So, you know, you're going to pay a little extra right now. If you get the rebate, that helps. And the same with the Bolt. I have not driven a Bolt for more than just a short test drive. But again, what struck me was how quiet and comfortable, and, you know, they put some sound deadening in here so you don't hear quite as much of the road noise as you used to hear. So I think what you're looking at is today's electrics are pretty much like a standard gasoline-powered car, but just with a different power plant in it. And, you know, a reminder, you don't have to do an oil change with an electric car either, so you save a little cash there, and not as much to wear out other than the electric motors. And so far, I've not heard anything about them wearing out particularly quickly. You know, the higher-end things are going to have a lot more bells and whistles on them, be a lot quieter, bigger, so you can throw more people and more gunk in the back and under the hatch. But I think for just the everyday driver who's going to use this for work, these are pretty much perfect little vehicles at this point. It's just got to negotiate your price a little bit, maybe.
I'll just counter the idea that electric cars are moving forward. I don't think they are as much. There are more choices for sure. But as far as range goes, the Leaf and the Bolt, along with Tesla, of course, are the ones that have actually committed to making longer range electric cars. The rest are still not particularly impressive as far as their range. I remember a few years ago, the BMW i3 was considered cutting edge, and they haven't really upped their game. So I would say that the same goes for most electric cars. They're still in that 60 to 80 mile range.
Well, I think part of that is that in between times theory that I have, and that is, a lot of those cars were created, you know, probably started to be created 4 to 7 years ago. And when they came out, that was as, you know, long a range as possible. Whereas the Leaf now is, I don't know, been out for 5 or 6 years, I think, and it's now in its second generation. And the Bolt was a follow-up for Chevy after they decided that the Volt wasn't going to do it for them. And I think you'll start seeing that these batteries start having a longer life and giving it a longer charge. And I know Leaf in particular has gone to a different battery format, and they're using manganese, not cobalt or nickel in theirs now, which still in theory allows it to charge quicker for those, you know, the normal version of this car. And, you know, I think that, again, it's just technology takes a while, and there's a lead time of, you know, 3 to 5 years on cars to get out there. So It may be that the next generation of the BMW and so forth, you may see that they have that. And I know people like Volvo have been talking about going all electric, and I think Volkswagen and Audi are along that same line. So you can be sure that they're going to have those long-range batteries in the cars as quickly as they possibly can. So, it may be another year or two for some of them, but I guess I'm just thinking that currently we've now got a couple of good choices for fairly inexpensive family cars that can get you to and from work and to the mall, as they say, and soccer practice and whatever else.
So is your overall impression then that since our last conversation about electric cars, that they have improved, that things are getting better, that both range and selection choices, et cetera?
Well, right. It's going to take a while for all of the car makers to catch up and do this. I think more of the car makers have just come out with hybrids in the last 2 or 3 years, and some of them with plug-in hybrids the last couple of years. And like I say, that's the in-between step. So maybe you don't have the technology or you don't have the numbers. Let's say a Mazda that maybe doesn't sell as many cars, they can't commit full-time to this, or Subaru. So they go to a hybrid first and then start working on the electrics for, I'm going to guess, 5 or 7 years down the road for them.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Good update on electric cars.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You'll find Mark Savage's latest auto review on the Nissan Leaf at WUWM.com and his website, SavageOnWheels.com. Savage is also the editor of Scale Auto Magazine, part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars, and you can explore their past segments at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then talk with writer David Sedaris about growing older and the challenges of mundane conversation. Lake Effect continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. If you've listened to public radio for just about any length of time, you've probably heard David Sedaris. The best-selling author has been a staple of public radio programs for years, including This American Life and Morning Edition. Before he left for upstate New York in June, Mitch Tyke had the good fortune to speak with Sedaris backstage at Boswell Book Company. Sedaris was in town to read from the paperback edition of his latest book, Calypso. We should note that the conversation took some clinical but mature turns along the way.
David Sedaris, it's a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for just taking a few minutes to talk.
Oh, I'm delighted.
Well, and I feel like public radio interviews always start with that pleasantry, like thank you for taking a few minutes to talk, but they never continue down the pleasantry road. So let me ask you this. How are you? How was your trip here?
I just started my book tour yesterday. So I have nothing to complain about, and I'm really fresh.
It's one of those things that you hear about among entertainers or musicians or whoever, that the audience doesn't care whether the flight here was good or bad. They just want a good show. But I get the feeling that people actually are interested in what the trip was like for you in some way.
I don't like it when I check into a hotel and they say, "How was your trip in?" Because they don't. It's just not a good question. I mean, most people are going to say fine. I mean, as a matter of fact, I arrived at the airport and found that all of my flights had been not canceled, but the travel agency didn't pay on time, and so all of my tickets were canceled, right? So it was a huge pain in the ass, but it wasn't interesting. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't... It wasn't like an altercation with someone on the plane or it's the kind of thing nobody would want to hear about except the people whose job it was to make sure the tickets weren't canceled. So that kind of thing is just, and really nobody wants to hear about it. So, but it's like when people say, "How are you?" Like a couple months ago, a doctor stuck a wire up my penis.
I have had that experience.
Into my bladder. And then for the first time when people said, "How are you?" I would say, "Well, actually..." And that's the only time I was thinking, oh, I hope they ask how I am, because I felt like I had something, a really good story.
To run the risk of actually relating this to Calypso for a second, one of the themes that seems to come through it is like this sort of gradual change that takes place and then the sudden realization that the change has been taking place all along.
Well, you know, I just reached the age, and it just seemed to happen overnight, where people say, sir, are you okay to go through the metal detector? And I think, what are you raising your voice for? I was in a hotel, and the internet wouldn't work, and it said, go downstairs and get a code. So I go downstairs, and the guy behind the desk says, you need to put your name where it says name, and then your room number. I said, you know I must seem terribly old to you, but actually, I do this every day. So I just became, overnight seemingly, where you say, hey, buddy, you dropped something. Now it's, excuse me, sir, you dropped something. So now I'm sir all of a sudden, which, again, I suppose, I mean, 62 years old, I suppose it makes sense, you know. But a lot of people said when this last book came out, oh, it's so much darker. And it wasn't a conscious choice. But, you know, as you get older, you know, your friends start dying and people get cancer and they get parts of themselves lopped off. And it just comes with the territory, you know, it's just part of aging.
I wonder, I mean, you have this large family that you come from, and is there a point in your family's existence and age where, you know, when you think about your family sitting around in, you know, at the holidays or something, is there an age that you imagine that they're all frozen at?
I was writing something about this a while ago. You know that, like, golden age where you're at a restaurant with your parents and somebody comes up, a stranger walks up to the table and says to your father, what a beautiful family you have. You know, I've signed books before and I've had those people in that golden age come up. You know, maybe the kids are aged like 17 through, like, 25, 22 or 25. And, you know, the parents are kind of still young enough. It was such a beautiful, it's such a beautiful time in the life of a family. And I know this sounds phony, but I'm okay with getting older, but I can't bear to see my sisters get older. It just hurts me so much. I just don't think it's fair. They were so beautiful. And they're not complaining about me, but I can't bear it.
Well, and I mean, I think that about my wife. I think that about my kids who are, you know, in their teens. I mean, I feel like, you know, I'm having nostalgia in advance. Like preemptory nostalgia. I was thinking about the first time I remember listening to you on public radio. I don't even remember honestly what the essay was, but it was at a time probably before I would have emailed someone a link to it, so it's a while now. I'm thinking about if it had been later. You write about being the struggling writer who, you know, maybe had $100 in your checking account when you go to check it on the ATM. Do you think if you had been the struggling writer in, say, 2005, would you have become a blogger?
I often wonder that, because I meet so many people and they, you know, maybe they self-publish something or maybe they have a blog and then they say, well, I just want to get it out there. And there's a lot to be said for not getting it out there, you know. So I started writing when I was 20, and I don't think anyone saw, outside of letters, a word that I had written until I was 28. And I'm glad of that, because it's just, I think people would have looked at what I'd written and said, okay, well, he's no good. And then I don't know that they would have given me a second chance. So I don't know. I just felt like I kind of sort of waited until I suspected that the time was right. So I hoped that I wouldn't have. But, you know, I often ask myself the same thing. If I were 20, would I have a tattoo? You know, I mean, I'm 62 and I don't have one and I don't plan on getting one. But if I was 20 years old and everyone around me, so I guess the thing, I feel like when I was like 14, I needed to do what everyone around me was doing to try to at least fit in some small way, or not to draw too much attention to myself. But I feel like that was the last time I felt the pressure to do that.
Yeah. You write in Calypso about being short. In fact, a few years ago, during one of the times that I introduced you on stage here in Milwaukee, you came out and I think you noted that we could have swapped clothes that night. I know you're right, you don't feel shafted by the height you ended up with, but what's your take on the way society seems to honor the opposite, largeness, you know, the catalogs and the stores catering to big and tall men, but not ones specializing. As far as I know, there's not a shop out there that I've found for short and slight men.
Well, my friend Max Brooks told me about a place in Los Angeles that specializes in short men, and he gets all of his suits there, and I don't remember the name of it. But if I had 100 wishes, I would not wish to be any taller than I am. If I had a choice of being taller or being shorter, I'd go with shorter. And the only thing that bothers me is when tall men think that they have something I want. And I don't want what they have. Absolutely not interested in it. I just never saw the benefit. But it was funny, the Washington Post has this column where they send two people on a date, right? And then they have deal breakers. Each person talks about, you know, well, I wouldn't never possibly, I draw the line. And there were they sent these two gay guys on a date, and their deal breaker was short men, not Nazis. not murderers, right? That was okay as long as they weren't short. I guess I'm just so puzzled by that because it would never, I don't know, it would just never occur to me. That would it would not be, when I see guys who are shorter than me, like, I mean, if I could shrink you, I'd do it. But then I don't necessarily want to be the taller one.
I don't remember. Have you written about how is Hugh taller than you?
Oh yeah, Hugh is. Oh, I don't know. Like he's 6'10". I mean, no, 5'10".
Okay.
You know, 5'10" or 5'11", something like that.
And it is not it is not an issue in your relationship.
Mm-mm, no.
This is a strange. I guess these have all been kind of strange questions. So I'm about to move, and pretty much every
move?
I'm moving to Northern New York. I'm taking a job managing North Country Public Radio in far Northern New York.
Where?
It's at St. Lawrence University in Canton.
Oh.
Or as we like to refer to it, suburban Montreal, about 2 hours south of Montreal. I have been in this job, hosting this show, for 13 years, and with that as the preface, reading this book and thinking about change, would you prefer your change quickly or slowly, as far as major transitions in your life go?
Gosh, probably I would say slowly. I mean, I wish I were more adaptable to change. Who was I with a while ago, and they were so refreshing to be with, just because they embraced everything. You know, like sometimes you wind up and you're sitting around with people, and then you start crabbing about, especially when you're crabbing about young people. Then you think, I don't know about this. This like seems like this is a bad road to go down, because how does that make me any different than my dad? My own dad. You know. And so I was with somebody who just kind of embraced everything. And I thought, God, that's the person I want to be. But I think maybe it's better. It's easier for me to kind of slowly ease into it. That said, I mean, a change in my life, like I'm happy, always happy to like, you know, if Hugh were to say, look, we're moving to Germany tomorrow, I'd say, okay. And I would look forward to it. Like a change like that for myself, great, I don't need 2 years to get used to the idea. I'll just go ahead and do it. But like a change in the country or something being phased out, Hugh and I just got a place in New York City, and you know, so many storefronts are empty and stores are just dying. You know, people are buying everything online. Not me, but everybody else is buying everything online and stores are dying. So would I rather wake up tomorrow and they're just gone? I'm not ready for that. So give me like 30 years.
Right. It's hard to watch the sort of atrophying of the retail sector.
Well, you know, it's just, I think the computer ate people's jobs, and then those people are eating other people's jobs, you know, because, you know, they're trying to save money because I think I'm the only person I know who's making more money than he made 10 years ago. And I blame the computer for everything.
I think at some level, maybe the question that was at the heart of it is, you know, there are times when something like that's happening that to me, I kind of just wish I could flash forward those 2 years or 4 years or 5 years and see how it comes, you know, almost like opening a book to the last page or the last chapter just to kind of gauge, you know, if it's going to go this way, let's get there already.
Well, that's funny. The New York Times contacted me today and they want me to write an op-ed piece from the future. And they don't, they know they don't, they're not really looking for Grimm. You know, I mean, you can go that direction if you want to. But, and so I just started wondering what that would be like. I'm not very good at, I mean, sometimes it's amazing to walk down the street and you think, oh my God, this is exactly what I thought the future was going to look like. Like everybody's connected to a device and my phone rings and then I'm talking into my watch. And this is exactly what, well, not exactly. Right. I mean, but when did this happen?
No, people aren't wearing fedoras quite as much as they seem to think we would. We're talking at Boswell Book Company just a few minutes before you're going to do a reading, and then you kind of have this open signing line that could last a long time. It probably will last a long time. What do you like about meeting people for those 10 seconds or minute and a half or whatever?
Well, it works for me. Like if I were at a cocktail party or something, I would be very uncomfortable. Partly because I think you talk to someone and then you think, oh, am I boring them? Do they want to get away? Or else you think, how am I going to get away? But this is kind of perfect because I sit at a table and people come to me. And then it kind of ends when I hand them the book back. But in the meantime, some amazing things can happen. I've talked to a doctor last night who told me, and she was a physician. She's becoming a psychiatrist, and told me about the great number of men who are convinced that their penises are retracting back into their bodies, and so they tie weights to them. Who on earth would ever suspect this was a thing, right? And so just something like that can just kind of keep me going. You know, you ask a few questions, and all of a sudden you're talking about something like that, and I just live for that. And I can't wait to go home and put it in my diary.
Well, and at a certain level, you kind of go into each encounter knowing what the, I hate this metaphor, but the rules of engagement are. I mean, this is the way this conversation will play out, and you don't have to think about the organic way to go up to someone at a cocktail party and just start talking.
Well, I think it's a bit different, too, because I'm sort of allowed to ask any question that I want, so it's a different kind of encounter. The problem is that then I go back to my hotel, and I'll be at the check-in desk, and I'll say to the woman behind the counter, are those your real teeth? You can't be doing that.
Well, we've managed to talk about penises twice in the course of this conversation, so I say job well done. I wish you years of urinary health.
Thank you so much.
David Sedaris, a real pleasure.
Thanks.
Writer David Sedaris speaking with Mitch Teich in June before a reading at Boswell Book Company. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.